Okay, that seems to be going, and I'll start my timer, too. Okay, Tom, before we get too far, how about telling us your complete name and any nicknames you might have gone by at Hanford?
Of course, my full name is Thomas B. Kelly. I've always been Tom.
Okay. And you're living in, what is it, Orange, Texas?
Yes. Orange, Texas.
Okay.
And my address, if you need it, is 290 Pine Lane.
Okay, thank you very much. So we are free to go in any direction and anywhere you'd care to start, and I guess I would like to hear, you know, before we're completely done, however long it takes, what you were doing before you were called up to the
Manhattan
Project.
Okay, well, this is why I mentioned about this book, because when this book came out and I read it, and I wrote the author a letter. And my comments in this letter are some of the information you want, I think. And the letter was written back in June 1967, so my memory was maybe as fresher then than it is now.
Right.
Okay, since I've just read your book, Manhattan Project, and want to congratulate and thank you. You've done an excellent job of telling the whole story in this most fascinating way. And I go on, and I said, I was one of the little people who was there, at least for part of it. I worked for the DuPont Company and was in TNX from the summer of 43 to 45. TNX was the department name that the company went by during that period.
Right.
And the book brought back many memories and experiences I will never forget. In that summer of 1943, I was an assistant superintendent in the production department at the Bell Works, Charleston, West Virginia, where I had helped start up our first commercial unit to make polyethylene for radar. I thought this was important work. This is an aside. Louis Alvarez, who was one of the experimental physicists that was in Chicago, mm-hmm. and worked on the bomb, and later worked on the hydrogen bomb. And one of the things we did when we were there at Chicago was that we played chess back and forth on the bus between the university
really?
And going out to the Argonne Forest.
Uh-huh.
I says, I remember how I felt when I was sent to Wilmington, where I interviewed Walt Simon, Monty Evans, and Roger Williams, and found out that I would be in the first group of DuPont men to be trained to operate valves at Hanford to produce plutonium for Navon. But I could not tell anybody what I was doing, not even my wife. This really was different and really was war work. And this is also an aside. It may very well be that one of the reasons I got picked was that Monty Evans and Walt Simon knew me probably from the Bell Works. One of them was, they were both in management there. One of them was the assistant plant manager, and the other was a plant superintendent. I had been involved in startup work prior to going to this polyethylene plant. And so I called, going back to the letter, I called her and told her the company would put our furniture in storage as we were going to Chicago for a few months. The 3 months turned out to be six.
Mm-hmm.
There, people like John and Leona Marshall, George Weil, and others taught us how to operate the pilot Argonne. There were five of us in this particular group. And the other four men, I think, had backgrounds like mine. They were production superintendents or supervisors or assistant superintendents and had been involved most of them in company war plants that were making explosives or special chemicals or that kind of stuff.
Okay.
We went on to Hanford eventually and were the shift supervisors who started up the 305 pile, the 105B, and the 105D pile. I never got to F pile.
Mm-hmm.
At the Argonne Forest, since Fermi's pile had been moved out there by the time we got there, we tested graphite and uranium samples, and at the Argonne Forest when we got to Chicago, we helped evaluate foil exposed in the file. And we attended lectures in the Met Lab by these physicists were in and out of the place, you know. When Fermi was at out at the Argonne Forest, where he usually had that bodyguard of his with him.
Yeah, yeah. Is that the one Leona Marshall talked about?
That same one.
Yeah, okay.
And as I guess I mentioned that in between times, a lot of times we played chess.
Yeah.
And in the letter I say, I guess if you can write about it, I can talk about it. I will never forget how sick we were when 105B died the first time, and people came in the control room to look at the charts. The speed with which the cure was found and the subsequent successful operation gave everyone confidence that real success was only a question of time. Now, I, from reading your moderator, you've had John Wheeler out there.
He was here in August, yes.
Did he talk to y'all and give us, or he was just a guest there?
He spoke to, we all met for dinner at a local restaurant, and he answered some questions, told some stories, and it was a very informal evening, but we did get to talk to him. The next day, we all went out to B Reactor, and he
regardless of the books you read and so on and what they say, I think he was probably the real key to the Xeon 135 problem, you know, that was mm-hmm. was killing the reaction.
And he before that had been sort of a liaison between DuPont.
Well, he was a consultant to DuPont. He was in the TNX department,
mm-hmm.
and was a consultant. And he from some of the things I read and what I have heard, he was the one that helped the engineering department come up with the fact that they needed more tubes than what the theoretical people
yes.
were saying.
Right.
And we can thank the good Lord that that's what happened.
Yeah. And is that how your letter ends, or does it go
on? No, I go on. Even though we did not know the whole story, when the little item about the explosion in New Mexico came out, we knew that the bomb had really worked. We were en route back to Charleston, West Virginia, when the first bomb dropped, and still in the hotel waiting for our furniture when the war ended. Our families knew then what we had been working on. These were experiences I am glad I had the opportunity to take part in, even though I remember that those first doubts about it, about what we were doing and what it would lead to when I learned that we were trying to build an A-bomb. And I asked him if he would, wouldn't it too much inconvenience if he'd autograph a copy of his book, and which he did. And
right.
As I say, if you don't have a copy, why, I think this is one I could donate to the library.
Spell the author's name.
It's, let me, I got it here, right here. I'm going to have to go back to my notes pretty soon.
Uh-huh.
Oh, Stephane, Stephane, Trouff.
Trouff.
And let me look in the front here, and I'll see to find the publisher. Yeah, he autographed this book for me in August 1967.
Yeah, great.
And in the letter that he wrote to me, he said the book was being getting ready to be printed in a couple of other countries.
Great. And what was he just writing about it, or was he somehow involved with the man?
Oh no, he was just a writer.
Uh-huh.
Well, the Library of Congress catalog card number is 6711. 231.
Okay. That's probably enough to find it.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay.
And before I forget, let me say that today is November 10th, 2000, and it's the day we recognize Veterans Day, so I guess I should wish you a happy Veterans Day, for, you know, considering that you were as much at the front lines in a funny kind of a way as everybody else.
I really wasn't a veteran, and you know, it's funny, my wife belongs to the DAR, and we go to this thing, and they have the veterans stand up and so on. They don't recognize people that worked in the war plant, which I think they should. And actually, there's another guy that lives here in Orange that worked out in the 200 area. Now, are you getting any of that in your...
We are working on a project about T-Plant, actually, the 221T building, the main canyon in the 200 West area.
Oh, I see. I think he was probably a chemist, a lab man.
Oh, really? Well, that would be interesting still.
He's on vacation right now, and not here, but I'll ask him if he minds. And if he doesn't, well, I'll give you his name.
Great.
And
I'd appreciate
phone number.
That. I think, you know, the bottom line is, if anybody is interested in telling us anything about their past experiences here, it's all quite valuable.
Okay, yeah. Well, yep. Another guy that you might want to talk to is another friend of mine that was in the Navy. And it turned out that the Navy assigned people down there to Knoxville, and he worked down there in the Knoxville separation
plant. Oh, really?
For a while, yeah. So if you're interested in talking to someone like that, right?
I think it would be valuable. Yeah, you know, whether we talk for an hour or 10 minutes, I'd definitely like to speak with the fellow. That'd be great.
I'll warn him too. You might get a phone call.
Great.
Let me go back to the other piece of paper I had here. Well, I had this other friend that I had that was out there. He was doing a contract history for somebody, and he wrote to ask me if I remembered the incident about the earthquake. He was the duty officer the day the galvanometer started jumping around, and I thought it could be an earthquake, and I called him to tell him, and I told him that we were still running, and I didn't see any reason to shut it down. And he in the office where he was, they had a chart that showed the level at which the piles were running.
Uh-huh.
And he said there was a little bobble on it, but it just barely wiggled. So.
And this was at B Reactor, or in Chicago?
No. This was 105B. This was when I was in the control room, and we were operating. And it was probably quite some time after the plant was started. We were running at 250,000 men.
Okay, let's put this in perspective. You left Hanford about what time of year?
Hanford in about the 1st of August, 1945. So this would have been probably not sometime after the reactors got up to full capacity. Let me go on and he says that in those days before the seismographs were put on the safety circuits, he says, after I told the story in AEC, he was working for the AEC, and in 1948, and got that seismologist from St. Louis to suggest the type and location. He floored, he told them it wasn't going to be very expensive. And according to him, they went ahead and installed them on the reactors. Now, you may find out from somebody later of if and when they did actually install something like that.
Okay, great.
Okay.
And what? But was the reactor set up to scram automatically if the galvanometer jumped too far?
I don't think so. Not when we were running.
Uh-huh.
I think this was the point Hike made. His name was E.F. Miller, Jr., and his nickname was Hike. I think the thing that came up, I don't know whether it had even been considered before, but it wasn't until, like I say, this is 1948 that he's talking about given the information to the AEC.
Right.
So.
What was your friend's name? Nickname?
His name was Hike, H-I-K-E.
Oh. Okay.
And E.F. Miller was his full name. He, he's dead now. Right?
Sure.
I'd get a hold of him.
Sure. Okay. So this was this story is still in your letter?
Well, this is a separate letter. This is in this letter I got here. It's a personal letter to a whole bunch of us. And,
okay.
But it's
okay.
What I'm quoting you is excerpts from it.
Right. Right. Great.
Okay. Well. I guess we've talked about the necessity for additional slugs from to get us up to capacity and rate all. Oh, the other note I had here. Do you have any interest? Hans Bethe, you know, was a Cornell alumni, and at the 50th, some of the 50th things that they had, there was an article about Hans Bethe in the Cornell Alumni News, and this is where I picked up this article. I didn't know and had never heard about the fact that 2 days before the scheduled test of the world's first atomic bomb, a test code named Trinity, disastrous news came from Los Alamos, the secret scientific compound to the full-size replica of the bomb, minus the plutonium, had just been exploded, and measurements of the implosion shock wave had indicated that in the real bomb, the wave would fail to uniformly compress the hollow plutonium sphere into a supercritical half ball, but would instead tear it apart. The real bomb would be a dud. Now, had you ever heard that story before?
No, I hadn't.
Well, why don't I just send you this?
Sure.
Well, you know who Hans Bethe is, don't you?
I know I've heard his name, but I couldn't tell you what he was doing there.
Well, he was the head of the theoretical physics group out at Los Alamos.
Oh, Hans Bethe?
Maybe I'm pronouncing his name wrong.
He pronounces, is it B-E-T-H-E?
That's it.
Yeah, Hans Bethe, he pronounces it, Bethe.
Yeah.
Okay. And well, that's where you're hearing this story.
Beg your pardon?
That's where you learned about the.
I was kind of quoting out of this article in the Cornell Alumni News when they had a celebration there. I'll just send you the article.
Okay, great. Copy of it would be wonderful. Okay.
I have about wound up, unless you want to ask me some. Questions.
Oh yeah, yeah. Let's. Tell me what you were doing for DuPont, and that was at the Bell Works before the war?
Right.
Or during the war. What was the Bell Works doing at the time?
Well, the Bell Works is a big plant, and...
In Charleston, Virginia?
Charleston, West Virginia.
Virginia.
West by God, Virginia. West Virginia,
I'll tell you. Thank you. Okay.
It was a small plant compared to the rest of the Bell Works, that the Navy provided the money to build this plant to make polyethylene, and it was called KLW, but for Crouch, Lockhart, and Wilson, who were the engineers that went to England and got some of the stuff and came up with a design for DuPont.
This was the name of the plant?
Yeah, well, yes, that was the name of the plant at the time.
KL, was that G?
Well, forget it. That's what it was called before.
Oh.
While I was still in the beginning when the plant was built, as I say, with Navy money, we were at the outskirts of the Bell Works because the only people who got in there were the people who were working on it. After we got into operation and we became a part of the DuPont operation, the material was Alathon, and Alathon is polyethylene. Polyethylene was one of the early plastics. Matter of fact, we and carbide were the only ones making it. This unit where we were made about 150 pounds an hour, and polyethylene was the first billion-pound-a-year plant, and I don't know how many billion pounds a year now is all over the world.
Why did the Navy want polyethylene?
They wanted for insulation, high frequency insulation for radar.
Ah.
And this is, I say, where I drew in Luis Alvarez's name, because when I, after we met him and found out that he'd been working on the design of radar, which we use in England, you know, to stop the, the bombers. Well, he was a young man at the time, like we all were, but he was a very fine physicist, and he, like I say, he worked there. He was Los Alamos, and watching the History Channel recently was the story of the hydrogen bomb, and sure enough, here was Luis Alvarez. And he's dead now too. I got a clipping out of the paper one time when he died, but he was one of the guys I played chess with.
And this, so you, and when was it that you were asked to go to Chicago? What month might that have been?
Oh, I see. That was July 1943.
And was it a local person at your plant who talked to you about the possible move?
No, that's what I was quoting from the letter. I went to Wilmington to interview Roger Williams, Monty Evans, and Walt Simon. Now, Roger Williams probably stayed in Wilmington. He was probably the top guy in TNX. Walt Simon was the plant manager at Hanford. And Monty Evans, I don't know whether he was just in and out from Wilmington or what, but Monty Evans was one of the DuPont people that insisted that they build a pilot plant. I mean, you know, the DuPont company was great. They didn't go into big projects without having pilot plants.
Right.
And I think the thing was they couldn't quite see going from Fermi's pile to the ones they were building out in Hanford. So they built the pilot plant. And
the one in Tennessee? Or the 305 pile?
Well, the one in Tennessee, I was down there for a couple of weeks. That was a little bigger one. And that one actually operated, I guess. But out at Hanford, they put it, in the, you know, in the 300 area. That's where the canning process was.
Okay. So when they interviewed you, was it just a one-day talk and then you were getting ready to go to Chicago?
Yeah, that was it. I called my wife from Wilmington and told her the movers would be coming to pack our furniture, and that was it.
Okay. And when did you actually arrive in Chicago, do you think?
Oh.
What month?
It was probably early August. I don't remember the exact date.
Yeah, but it was soon after your interview.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I came home and got ready to go, I think.
And this is August 1943.
So I was in TNX 2 years.
Okay, right.
Now, like Bill McHugh came from, I believe, from Morgantown. We had a... See, it also was in the ammonia department. And Monty Evans, after he left Bell, was the plant manager at Morgantown. So he probably knew Bill, too.
Okay.
And at the end of the war, or I mean in 1945, when DuPont started peeling off the people that were there early, I didn't have any choice. They were sent me back where I came from. And I went into nylon production.
Okay.
Nylon intermediates. Now, some of the others, like Bill, had a choice, and Bill stayed, and like I say, he's still there.
Yeah. So, how much did you understand about the nature of the work when they first interviewed you or when they got you to Chicago?
Well, like I say, in the interview, Walt Simon and Ronnie Evans, they told us, of course we were sworn to secrecy and all that stuff, but they told us what we would be doing. And they told us what the company was trying to do, you know, to make plutonium.
They told you the whole darn
thing. They told us the story.
Wow.
But, you know, the out at Hanford, the construction people, the operators, they really didn't know.
Right, right.
And we really weren't supposed to be talking to 200 area people or anything like that. Well, another man from Charleston that was there was at Knoxville. He was an analyst, I remember we were living in an apartment, and we had about a year and a half old baby, he had children. Well, he was sent down to Knoxville at Christmas time, and we just went. Joe and Mary and I went over and stayed with him over Christmas, and I put the tree up and got the toys ready for. They had boys, and it was like I say. Some of us knew each other to a degree as we went out from our common backgrounds.
Uh-huh. Now, this whole time, you were still working for DuPont, and you were still totally...
This is DuPont. See, the TNX... Yeah. DuPont... We were DuPont employees. DuPont, if I remember the contract, they took it to build, design, build, and operate for a contract of $1.
Right.
And that's all the company got out of it.
Yeah,
But we all got paid. We got our travel expenses, and we got like that. We were well treated.
Uh-huh. And where did you? What were you in an apartment in Chicago? They moved.
Yes, we. Well, Joe still claims we were in the slums. Actually, we were in a furnished apartment on Blackstone Avenue between 55th and 56th Street. If you know Chicago,
I don't, but I'll make a note of that. Okay.
But it was close. To the university.
Okay.
We walked to the university and either stayed there for the day to go to lectures and stuff, or we took the bus and went out to the Argonne Forest.
Okay.
I mean, to us at the time, it was the Argonne Forest. I mean, nobody even around there even knew what was back there. I don't think you couldn't get in.
Right. And did it feel like everybody was under a certain amount of pressure, and yet the job was going to last a couple of years. What was the pace like on a day-to-day basis?
Well, it was a work-a-day. I mean, and as I remember, we worked 6 days a week instead of five or something like that, seemed like, if I remember correctly. But that would probably come out of the records.
Right.
And now Ray Dahl... when he was in Chicago, I think he told me they were in a little building separate from the West Stands, but it was a little building there in Chicago where they worked before he went to Hanford.
Okay. Had they already dismantled the first pile, the famous pile?
Yes, when we got there, it had been moved to the Argonne Forest.
Okay.
So I never did see the original one.
So was there still any graphite pile work going on at the university, or had it all been moved?
As far as I know, it had all been moved.
Okay. Okay. And what sort of things...
beg your pardon?
I was wondering what sort of things they were... you were being trained as well as doing work with them, right?
That's right.
And what sort of training were they giving you?
Well, out in the Argonne Forest, we actually sat down and operated the pile. They, they showed us what to do and about how you pull the rods out and what meters you watched and that kind of stuff.
And so I guess since they had told you everything, you could have a very clear understanding of what was happening when you pulled the rods out.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, I mean, actually, when we were... going to these lectures there in Chicago, these lectures were all about nuclear reactions and all that kind of stuff.
So, and then you would go and apply what you had learned actually operating a pile at Argonne.
Well, that's right. I mean, John Marshall and Leona, John and Leona Marshall were the close. And if you see the pictures and read the accounts of when they operated the thing, George Weil was the guy that pulled the rods out for Fermi when they when they started it up the first time. I don't know what happened to him after we left, but he was very close there. We were around him every day, and it was a period that we were told it was going to be about 3 months.
Uh-huh.
Well, actually, it turned out to be about 6 months. And when I went to Hanford at the end of that 6 months.
And that would have been in...
Well, that was...
Early 45, 44?
Early 44, along January or so, I guess. Along then, my wife and the baby, they went back to West Virginia, and Joe and Mary stayed with her parents.
Okay.
And it was the kind of thing that went on. Of course, there wasn't any housing in Richland yet. There was the transient quarters, and there were some dormitories.
Uh-huh.
But we lived in the dormitories until the first house was built, the first housing was built. And I had a laundry case like I'd used in college. I'd send my laundry home and go do the laundry and send it back to me. We'd,
uh-huh.
we'd hang our shirts and let them air out as long as they could, you know, and that kind of stuff.
Right. And when you came out to Hanford, how did you travel here?
Oh, but it was by train.
Okay. Okay.
And when our furniture, they boxed, they didn't ship you out in a van. They loaded the furniture in freight cars. They van loaded freight cars to ship the furniture out.
Okay.
And they shipped our car out.
Really? And when was that all happening? How soon after you got
here? Well, that was about how many months, Joe? 6 months or 3 months? About 3 months, I guess.
So still wintertime, early spring.
Oh, yeah, it was still winter.
Still winter of 44.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the other kind of interesting thing about we married people were assigned to housing. We lived in what they called an H house on Goethals Drive, out near where the bus parking lot was. I don't know what's out there now.
What was the cross street near there?
Too long ago, I don't
remember. Okay. Yeah, I live like one block from Goethals.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, of course, everything was all sand out there, and the day some of the buddies, Bill and so, helped unpack the boxes, and we'd put the boxes out by the door, and the wind would carry the boxes away.
Oh, boy.
And, of course, until people got grass in their yards, when you'd have these windstorms, the sand would, dust would come in through the windowsills and stuff like that, like your homes in the north, like the snow comes through. Well, you had to clean up the dust all along.
Now, West Virginia is a fairly damp, lush place.
Oh, yeah.
What was it like coming here then? How'd your wife react? How did you take it?
Oh, we survived.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you knew it was war work, and I guess she did, and you were young enough.
Yeah.
It was an adventure.
We enjoyed it. We had friends there, you know, and there wasn't a whole lot.
Great.
We had a couple of vacations that they gave us gas, so you could take a vacation. We drove to Victoria one time, and
uh-huh.
we went to. But it was interesting.
What kind of work did they have you doing the first few months you were here?
You mean at Hanford?
Yeah, when you got to Hanford, what was your first introduction?
Well, of course, we were getting ready to start up the 305 pile.
Okay.
See, it was ready ahead of the big reactors.
Right.
So we were there writing operating instructions and getting ready to run it.
And the writing operating instructions were sort of based on what you'd been doing back in Chicago?
That's right.
Uh-huh. When do you think you actually got the pile started up?
I don't have any way of remembering that much detail.
Was it real soon after you got there?
You'd have to get that out
sure.
of some of the DuPont. There must be reports.
And then you did testing, didn't you, of the materials for the pile?
In the 305 pile, we tested graphite and uranium.
Mm-hmm.
Of the lots and so on. The graphite that they were getting ready to put in the big pile and the uranium that was going to go into slugs.
Uh-huh. And when you say test it, in a nutshell, how did that work?
Well, you brought it up to a level, and they made readings that the other people would. We didn't actually interpret the results
right.
that we got. We just
right.
operated it.
And logged the data for what the readings
logged
were.
Log the data and load the. Uranium, load the samples in and out,
right.
that kind of thing.
And do you remember what sort of power levels that reactor operated at?
No, they were pretty low.
Pretty low? But it was still shielded, right?
As I remember, yes.
Yeah, okay. And at what point did they actually take you out to one of the big reactors? And what was your introduction to the real reactors?
Well, they were still under construction, and we kind of during the time of the period we would be inspecting and checking, and when got ready to go with initial trial things and things like that that you had to do before.
Okay. And so you were at B when they got it started up?
Well, like I say, we were the people that actually started it up.
Mm-hmm. And what was your title, shift supervisor?
We were shift supervisors.
Okay.
And since there were five of us, there were four of us that had covered the shifts, and the fifth one was kind of a supervisor. And Kent Wyatt, I believe, was they called it the P department.
Right. That was the reactor operations?
Yeah, that was the operation.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember which time of the day? According to what I've read, the reactor started up late on the September 26th, late in the day, is when they started it up for real, going to go into production.
Yeah.
And it got poisoned, 10 hours later or something like that.
Yeah.
Where were you during that phase?
This went through several times that this happened. I don't remember exactly what shift I was on, but
mm-hmm.
because... we were operating. It was 24-hour operation, and this went through several times. People like Leona Marshall were actually there at the time it was going on.
But you understood, since you knew all about it, that something was wrong.
Oh,
rods
yeah.
were all the
oh,
way
yeah.
out.
We knew there was something wrong.
Uh huh. So. Your shift intersected with the real problems happening.
Then the next shift would come along, and they'd go through it again. They went through it several times while they were checking the half-life, I guess, so that... And like I say, John Wheeler was... of course, he at Princeton had done some work prior and knew a little bit about what could happen.
Yes. I think what he told us was they had definitely suspected that poisons could be created, but they drastically underestimated how big of a poison xenon would be.
Well, of course, they didn't have any way of testing at power till we started up
That's
the
right.
reactor.
Uh-huh. What was it like during, after they figured out the xenon and you started loading more fuel, were things pretty straightforward at that point and moving as expected?
Well, it took time. Like I say, the actual operation of loading more tubes and the 300 area, they didn't have a stockpile of them enough to do it. They were making them while they were filling it, so it didn't happen overnight.
Okay, they literally had to wait for them to produce more fuel for them.
That's right.
Wow.
Now that's the other thing. This Paul Vanderwart, that worked in the 200 area, they, I think they were brought over to be part of the loading crew to actually put them in. So I guess one thing, I don't know whether it was one of the letters I wrote or mentioned or not, but that eerie color that you would see when the slugs were dumped and when you know they pushed out and they went in a freight car full of water.
Uh-huh.
You never forget it once you've seen it.
Looking down into the fuel basin.
Yeah.
Oh. And then you knew that the darn thing had been working. Right?
Oh yeah.
You could see it.
I think I've given you about all I can think of at the moment.
Okay.
But I'll try to get you. I'm going to try to find get a hold of Ed Montgomery because, like I say, he was the guy on our shift that went around and took readings to check for radiation and leaks and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. No, that would be good. That would be good. Tell you what, you said you could mail me a copy of your the article.
Yeah, I'll get this.
Great. Yeah, that would be nice.
I was looking for. Maybe you better give me your address again right now because I was looking for it before.
Okay. It's 1414 Johnston Avenue. And that's in Richland, 99352.
That number again? Area code?
The zip or the area code?
Well, you gave me Johnston Avenue.
Richland 99352.
99352.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great. Well, I would appreciate that.
Very good.
And if we could do this again at some point, maybe we'd zoom in on some other topics, but I certainly appreciate it. And I hope we get a chance to meet at some point.
Well, I'm not sure whether... what we're going to do about our family reunion this year. Our daughter has had a brain cancer, which she's hopefully getting over with.
And oh, dear.
So, what I would like to know, and from reading the material, you're not going to have it open to the public for a while.
Not for real, no. But there will be tours this summer for the public.
Okay, well, what I was going to say was, if you will let me know as far in advance as you can when a tour would be,
right.
I'll try to check out whether, and if we can't have a family reunion, maybe I can get my son to come out with me or something.
That would
like
be
that.
Great. And you're thinking not soon, but next summer sometime?
Sometime.
Okay.
Just whenever you get... tour scheduled, just let me know when they are.
Okay, Tom.
Very good.
Well, look, thanks very much. I do appreciate it.
You bet.
We'll talk to you again. Okay,
bye-bye. Bye-bye.